Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks and the Learning College. Today, we're going to look at Freud from a white perspective in our fifth recording session from The Ordeal of Civility, Freud, Marx, Levi-Strauss, and the Jewish Struggle with Modernity. This will complete the Freud section, chapter 13, page 104 through 116. Everything that we record can be found at vnnforum.com. I'm Alex Slender, and you can also find this at alexslender.com. You can follow me on Twitter as well. And this is basically a different way of looking at Freud, someone who is turning Jewish social unease into universal medical symptoms with his new pseudoscience or veiled politics of psychiatry. Chapter 13 is Reich and Later Variations. And like I said, this is about 238 pages of text, and so far it's all been Freud, and this is the closing chapter on Freud. And so let's begin. Politically, Freud was a liberal. Diaspora liberalism may be defined as the endeavor to institutionalize, quote-unquote, neutral social territory between the Jew, the id, and the Gentile world, the superego. It was the ego, the putatively neutral instrumental ego, that would hold its own neutral scientific ground by playing off the id against the superego against the id. Freud had no desire to use psychoanalytic theory, much less the psychoanalytic situation, the decorum-free consulting room, as a staging area for launching a revolutionary drive against the Gentile civil society, which was its milieu. In a long life, at the end of the first century of Jewish emancipation, that would be the 1800s basically, he had settled his accounts with the Gentile superego. There would be no revolution from below. The superego, he had found, as Donald Barr writes, is as savage as the id, but on the side of decorum. Freud opted for a standoff. Freud himself stood polarized between the subculture of the id, and the incompletely internalized culture of the goy, the superego, what the Jews like him, who are rough Galician types, were assimilating to, as we've been hearing all book long. Between pariah and parvenu, there was a small margin of self-determination which, as Philip Reeve has observed, amounts merely to a skill at playing off against one another the massive sub-individual, id, and the supra-individual, superego, forces by which the shelf is shaped. Freud's famous formula, where id was, let there ego be, there let ego be, where id was, there let ego be, was both a call and a warning to diaspora Jewry and to non-Jews by extrapolation, that they come, quote, up from Yiddishkeit, unquote, but not try to assimilate to Goyishkeit, Goyishness. It was to be the great compromise of classical 19th century liberalism, but retooled for emancipating Jewry. On Freud's theory of the psychoneuroses, every symptom making up the various syndromes of his neurotic patients involved precisely such a compromise. Each of the 10 defense mechanisms, from isolation and reaction formation to projection and sublimation, there's an asterisk in there, it is Freud's daughter who finds that to his 9 methods of defense we must add a 10th, sublimation or displacement of instinctual aims. Anna Freud, The Ego and the Mechanisms of Defense. See Note 3, page 47. Each of the 10 defense mechanisms, from isolation and reaction formation to projection and sublimation, was involved in the production of compromises that would disguise the id, enabling it to pass as normal. Modernizing Jewry had repressed the processes involved in the forced march into the normal gentility that it had undergone upon entering Europe, when the unconditioned wish of a Maimon or a Marx collided with the demands of a Gentile restraint structures. Freud creates in the psychoanalytical situation a moratorium, a decompression chamber, an epoch of the Gentile attitude in which these, quote, defensive processes are reversed. A passage back into consciousness is forced for the instinctual impulses, or affects, emotions, which have been warded off, and it is then left to the ego and the superego to come to terms with them on a better basis. Within the scientifically legitimated precincts of this psychoanalytic interstitial social situation, with the social pressure of Western civility provisionally abated, checked at the door of Freud's insulting room, with Gentile politeness suspended for the interims etiquette of an analytic hour of uninhibited yet institutionalized vulgarity, Freud's Jewish patients could take time out from the hard praxis of passing to let a little air out of the thing. They could stop behaving and live a little. Bracketed outside, of course, the public authority of the real world, of the reality principle of the Gentile, continued its reign unabated. Once out there again, plagued by Gentile exigency, all would be once more compromise, but conscious, knowing, illusionless compromise. You may suspend ethics and still have a tolerable world, but when you eliminate also the appearance of the ethical, namely manners, nihilism is born. Freud was resentful enough to try this experiment, cautious enough to limit it. He compromised. James Joyce, analogously, broke the bourgeois novel's conventions with his version of free association, namely the monologue intérieur. What for Henry James had been the terrible fluidity of self-revelation became for Joyce a technique of deliberate vulgarity. Joyce and his Dubliners, like Freud and his shtetl Jews, coming from behind, in quotes from behind, in the 19th century, had to make, quote, a wilderness in the clearing of bourgeois Christian respectability so that their Irish and Jews could breathe. Both operated within a restricted context, the novel form and the form of the psychoanalytical situation. Both constructed, quote, imaginary gardens with real toads in them, named Anna O. and Leopold Bloom, who's a hero of Joyce's work. Psychoanalysis was to be an ideology, a compromise strategy for living the diaspora, the price of emancipation. Repression and sublimation was to be paid, and paid in full, but consciously and without adopting any of the illusory ideologies that the Gentile needed to console himself with for the renunciations exacted by civilized life. This hybrid, which is Gentile civil society, is no genuine synthesis of the id and superego, of nature and values. Its meditations or mediations between these hateful contraries, like the mediations of Hegel's system which reflected them, were illusions, lies that pretended to overcome the conflict. But like the ultimate lie of salvation that informs them all, they only paper over an inescapable conflict. We must live this compromise and not destroy it. We do not know what might erupt on its destruction, but we must live it consciously as far as possible and without illusion. The inner ethnic resonance of Freud's liberalism was twofold. On the one hand, he was playing the typical role of the advanced intelligentsia of a recently decolonized people. He was part of an elite, mediating them over the hill into modernity, sacrificing as little as possible of their traditional shtetl past, their id Yiddishkeit. This is the culture broker aspect of liberalism, with the neutral, instrumental ego of the mediator negotiating between plural interests, interest group liberalism, parentheses, within a given framework of public values, parentheses, the imperial Gentile order. But also, like a lawyer, the analyst was a double agent, representing both public Gentile authority, the reality principle, and the private subcultural interests of his client, the wishes of the pleasure principle. He stood, as I have said, between the id and the superego, between tradition and modernity, between pariah and parvenu. For all his fierceness, then, Freud represented the compromise that was to become diaspora liberalism. He turned his face against the wholeness hunger, asterisk. The author of this concept, Peter Gay, Weimar Culture, See Note 7, uses wholeness hunger with a wider generality of reference than I do. I make it an analytical tool for understanding the Jewish emancipation. For all his fierceness then, Freud represented the compromise that was to become diaspora liberalism. He turned his face against the wholeness hunger, a great regression born from a great fear, the fear of modernity, that covertly drove certain of the diaspora intelligentsia to seek a radical social fulfillment of their pre-modern wish. Marx, LaSalle, Rosa Luxemburg, Trotsky, Emma Goldman, Jerry Rubin, and Abby Hoffman. Freud kept a close watch on the political radicals and revolutionaries. After all, his schoolmates Heinrich Braun and Victor Adler were both active in politics. It was not till the early 30s that Freud fully realized that his own movement contained an analyst, Wilhelm Reich, who had gone back to Marx and contracted political fanaticism, as Jones calls it, Ernst Jones, a situation that led to Reich's estrangement and expulsion in 1934 from the movement. In 1933, Reich had been expelled from the German Communist Party for an incorrect view of the causes of fascism. Thus, Reich's attempt to marry two of the diaspora ideologues, Freud and Marx, ended in his separation from the two movements, speaking in their names. Reich soon left for exile in Scandinavia, one thinks of Marx and Heine in Paris, and then Marx in England, whence in 1939, due to the efforts of his American translator and friend, the New York psychiatrist Theodore P. Wolfe, he left for the U.S., settling in Forest Hills. Asterisk. I was myself for a short time a patient of Dr. Wolfe. The price then, late 40s, was $25 an hour. I still have the canceled check. That would have been a very, very large amount of money back then. So Reich tries to marry Marxism and psychology and basically gets kicked out of them. Born in Bobrisnia, Galicia, in 1897 to middle-class Jewish parents, a mother who eventually killed herself, and a father who raised cattle for the German government, Reich had an odd childhood. His was a parvenu family, proud and much more identified with German culture than with their Jewish heritage. Neither Wilhelm nor his brother, Robert, David Elkin writes, were allowed to play with the peasant children or with the Yiddish-speaking children of the ghetto. After World War I, while still a medical student, he became a practicing psychoanalyst in Freud's circle in Vienna. He was soon to show his independence by innovating theory and techniques which, while originating in Freud, ended Freud's conservative, stoic-liberal compromise and detonated the dynamite of social critique still bound in Freudianism. Like an electron would be bound in physics. Reich became, in his own eyes, a revolutionary Prometheus. He considered himself Freud unbound, and his appeal went well beyond psychoanalytical circles. Reich appealed to many for several reasons. He combined the psychological and the sociological, depth psychology, and radical politics. He was a theoretical materialist who created, nevertheless, a formalist therapy in which the content of analysis, dreams, free associations, slips, became less important than how the content was expressed. The adverbs of content, hand clasps, mannerisms, dress, gait, physiognomy, and so forth. But Reich's most important discovery, or most important contribution, his most famous, was his delusionary discovery of orgon energy, O-R-G-O-N-E, was in therapy. He analyzed the latent character resistance before tackling the patient's symptoms. Sounds a little like Scientology, doesn't it? Resistance to the primary rule, quote-unquote, of psychoanalytic candor, the ethic of honesty, Reich believed, took the form of character resistance, the defenses against insight into the infantile sources in the id, of the patient's current pathology, anchored themselves in the very physiology of the body, in stiff upper lips, in the tendency to grin and bear it, in evasive movements of the eyes, in shielding the genitalia by crossing the legs, in the last stronghold of retreating anxiety, a rigid pelvis. Most important of all in Reich's appeal to the Freudian left is the application he made of the idea of character armor. He called the rigid surface of the neurotic personality Charakterpanzerung, character armor, a kind of like panzer, right? Charakterpanzerung. A kind of hard cuticle defending the ego against the urgent, vital sexuality repressed within and clamoring for release through revolutionary praxis. The analogy here to Reich's namesake and heir, Charles Reich, is, quote, no accident. In Reich II, Charles, the masculine genitality of Reich I's 30s protest has been tenderized into the soft androgyny of the American 70s, where ingenuous green shoots of the greening of America, that was the title of his book, make their way up through the civilities of the Gentile Gesellschaft of consciousness too. Consider a social event among professional people, a dinner, cocktail party, garden party, remember Freud's picnic, or just a lunch among friends, Reich II asks us. Everything that takes place occurs within incredibly narrow limits, he continues. The events are almost completely structured around conversation. No one pays any central attention to the food, the mind-altering experience of the drink, or to the weather, or to the nonverbal side of personality. They do not strive for genuine relationships, but keep their conversation at the level of sociability. In Reich II, the grief of Reich I is audible once more. In 1947, Summerhill's A.S. Neal witnessed a social visit to Reich I at Organon, Maine, by former staff, down from Canada and dropping by. The guest apart, quote, poor Reich sat in a corner with a face full of misery. When we were alone, he said, Neil, I just couldn't go through an afternoon like that again. Gesellschaft's conversation just means hell to me. So it's all at that sort of bourgeois social level. Years before, in 1912, Franz Kafka had written, conversation takes the importance, the seriousness, and the truth out of everything, I think. The name Reich I gives to Reich II's consciousness II is character armor, and in his great work, Character Analysis, his first and archetypal example of it is politeness. If, for instance, a patient is very polite, Reich writes, while at the same time he brings ample materials, say, about his relationship with his sister, one is confronted with two simultaneous contents of the psychic surface, his love for his sister and his behavior, his politeness, both have unconscious roots. Analytic experience shows, he maintains, that behind this politeness and niceness there is always hidden a more or less unconscious, critical, distrustful, or deprecatory attitude. Reich's emphasis, always. Behind this politeness there is always a hidden, more or less unconscious, critical, distrustful, or deprecatory attitude. Reich's emphasis. So he advises the therapist, do not interpret the incestuous material, but, seizing the initiative, go after the politeness itself. Were one to wait until the patient himself begins to talk about his politeness and its reasons, one would wait forever. The patient will never talk about it himself. It is up to the analyst to unmask it as a resistance. It is Reich's contention that, since politeness immediately turns into a resistance, all content passing through it takes the impress of its form. To remain with the example of politeness, he writes, not, I should think, a difficult resolve for Reich. The neurotic, as a result of his repressions, has every reason to value highly his politeness and all social conventions and to use them as a protection. It is more pleasant, Reich concedes, to treat a polite patient than an impolite, very candid one, since the latter tells the analyst the unpleasant things which politeness would otherwise censor. Reich goes on to give 8 examples of the kind of aggressive utterance that remains hidden behind the armor of politeness, telling the analyst that he is too young or too old, or he has a shabby apartment or an ugly wife, that he looks stupid or too Jewish, that he behaves neurotically, and better go for analysis himself, and so forth. One must avoid, he warns the therapist, any deep-reaching interpretations of the unconscious as long as the wall of conventional politeness between patient and analyst continues to exist, especially with obsessive-compulsive characters who have converted their hatred into politeness at all cost. In his descriptions of these latently, that is, characteriologically restrained patients, these good, over-polite, ever-correct patients, Reich turns obsessively to the wearers of the all-pervading nice bourgeois smile. There are inner and outer smiles, and those who are always armored, who smile inwardly about everything and everyone, and those whose resistance expresses itself in formal aspects of the general behavior, the manner of talking, of the gait, facial expression, and typical attitudes such as smiling, deriding, haughtiness, overcorrectness, the manner of the politeness, or of the aggression, etc., Reich's emphasis. Both the inward smile of the bourgeois interior and the relentless social niceness of the bourgeois exterior were fair game for Reich's revolutionary therapy. Freud's therapy had remained to the end a talk therapy. Indeed, notes George Steiner, Freud's raw material and therapeutic instrument are no less verbal, no less rooted in language than the art of Balzac or Proust. This is such an obvious point that it was long overlooked. Psychoanalysis is a matter of words. Words heard, glossed, interpreted, stumbled over, exchanged. Freud could only ask you in words to leave your good behavior outside of the analytic situation. Reich's technique of vegetotherapy ended the verbal era of psychoanalysis. If good behavior had anchored itself in the body's musculature, Reich directly attacked it by literally laying his hands on it and trying to break this armor plating into little free-floating pieces which would then stream toward the last line of defense, the pelvis. Reich, like Freud before him and like Charles Reich after him, constructs a tripartite model of man that recapitulates in its layering once more the historical phylogeny of Jewish emancipation. Asterisk. This Reichian model of patriarchal authoritarian man and family was influential among the Frankfurt circle of diaspora intellectuals, Eric Fromm, Theodore Adorno, Ted Adorno, and Herbert Marcuse. Ted, Herb, Eric, all Jews. And we know the Frankfurt School and the deliberate releasing of the Aryan through restraint in order to destroy his society and their academic study of the authoritarian personality that came about in the 40s and 50s. So Reich goes beyond Freud to attack the body defense. He begins at the end with the cultured Philistinism of the passing parvenu, block quote. Thus, what is called the cultured human came to be a living structure composed of three layers. On the surface, he carries the artificial mask of self-control, of compulsive insincere politeness, and artificial sociality. With this layer, he covers up the second one, the Freudian unconscious, in which sadism, greed, lasciviousness, envy, perversions of all kinds are kept in check, without, however, having in the least any of their power. There must be a word missing there. Lost any of their power, I would guess. The second layer is the artifact of a sex-negating culture. Consciously, it is mostly experienced only as a gaping inner emptiness. Behind it, in the depths, live and work natural sociality and sexuality, spontaneous enjoyment of work, capacity for love. The third and deepest, representing the biological nucleus of the human structure, is unconscious and dreaded. It is at variance with every aspect of authoritarian education and regime. It is, at the same time, man's only real hope of ever mastering social misery. So, and that's not true. That's not how it is. That's a theory they put forward in order to justify and destroying that outer shell of civility and niceness, introducing the reign of free love, which, as E. Michael Jones would say, is closely allied to political revolution, because when you lose the sexual restraints, everything else goes along with it. And all this in the theory that, hey man, let it all hang out, do what you want, do your own thing, float your boat, people will be relaxed and natural, they just have to quit conforming, man. The whole hippie mentality starts off stiff in the older guy, Wilhelm Reich, but then by the Greening of America and Charles, they're preaching that open. Essentially, free love is a fair summary of it. And remember, like he says in the asterisk, this Reichian model of patriarchal authoritarian man, which they claim is the personality of the Aryan innately, it's so different from their Jewish way in the shtetl, was influenced the Frankfurt circle of diaspora intellectuals, Erich Fromm, Theodor Adorno, and Herbert Marcuse. So, three layers. Here, in Reich's third layer, we have the ancestor of Charles Reich's consciousness 3, natural sociality versus artificial sociability. Yeah, man, we're trying to reach something deeper. Remember in Hillary Clinton's speech to graduating at Yale, I forget the exact words, but it was along those lines. More penetrating and ecstatic modes of living, something like that. That is the sort of mentality that people like Reich are pushing. If you give up your natural self-control, polite behavior, you'll break through to this wonderful natural savage underneath all the falseness and the trappings. Reich 1 carried Freud out of the consulting room and into the streets of the 1930s and 1940s, attacking the, quote, insincere politeness and artificial sociality of the civil society of the Gentile that Marx had attacked long ago with his call for a Gemeinschaft community grounded in man's species being. Reich refused the brutal bargain of assimilation. He rejected the price in social misery and social discomfort of becoming a member in good standing of bourgeois Gentile Europe. Quote, the cultivated European bourgeoisie of the 19th and early 20th century, he writes, had taken over the compulsive moral forms of feudalism and made them into the ideal of human behavior. Cudahy emphasizes human. Invited to become citizens at the time of emancipation, early 1800s. Lured by the promise of a kind of Greek polis, the emancipated Jew found himself in the meshes of a bourgeois and secularized Christian society, defining itself in universalist terms. As Freud and Herzl before him, Reich sees Europe's civility and its bourgeois Christian restraint as a hypocritical facade disguising anti-Semitism. So then he puts forward a hypocritical solution that's promoting anti-Goyism, or Loxism, as I call it. The forces which had been kept in check for so long by the superficial veneer of good breeding and artificial self-control, he writes, now borne by the very multitudes that were striving for freedom, broke through into action. In the concentration camps, in the persecution of the Jews, in fascism, he concludes, the psychic mass disease revealed itself in an undisguised form, i.e. the Goyim were daring to resist the Jewish communists. The Kulturkampf, cultural struggle latent in Freud, assumes in Reich overt and undisguised form. The seeds of paranoid thinking in Reich, later to flower in his conviction of a ubiquitous emotional plague, are already in evidence in the Reich of the 30s and 40s. Herzl's dictum that all Gentiles come in two and only two forms, overt and covert anti-Semites, is reformulated by Reich into his 1942 declaration that there is not a single individual who does not bear the elements of fascist feeling and thinking in his structure. The seeds of paranoid thinking begin, and it is of the utmost importance that we understand exactly where they begin, in his violent encounter with that seemingly most superficial of things, the polite civil surface of Western social intercourse. Hello. Goodbye. Nice to see you. Beg your pardon. Would you mind if... My view, on the other hand, is rather that... And that was a quote, too, as an example of Western social civil surface, polite. Polite civil surface of Western social intercourse. Would you mind if I... My view, on the other hand, is rather that it is this surface of the bürgerliche Gesellschaft that bugs and infuriates each generation of shtetl Jewry emancipated into the West. Somehow this civil surface is nothing, a mere appearance, a mere concern for how one looks before someone. Anyone, a stranger, this civil, polite surface is nothing, yet somehow mysteriously everything. It seems to carry in secret, secularized form the very meaning of European civilization. Reichs is a classical, almost textbook case of the violent encounter of the tribal society, of the shtetl, with the civil society of the West. As it takes bourgeois form in the 19th and 20th century Europe and Anglo-America, Freud had pulled his punches, his wanted bourgeois liberalism. Reich refused, and his principal delict of incivility eventually became the tort for which he was imprisoned in March 1957 in the federal penitentiary at Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. He died there of a heart attack on November 3, 1957. Irving Goffman, in our own day, is the first to thematize, to raise explicit consciousness, this interlink in the West between lunacy and public incivility. Reich paid the price of an ultimate testing of this link. Philip Reif describes Reich's thrust in the following way, black quote, "On the level of action, there is the sham social surface of the superego, where the human appears restrained, polite, compassionate, and conscientious. But this hammering of the superego is the rubber glove with which repressions maintain their sterile grip on character. In Reich's terms, the tragedy of being moral occurs because the polite social surfaces of character are separated from the deep natural core by repressions masquerading as the very instincts that they repress. The lesson to be drawn was clear: abolish repressions masquerading as the very instincts that they repress. Abolish the repressions masquerading as the very instincts that they repress. This was the therapy and tactic of Reich's Freudo-Marxism. If, and only if, a therapeutic aim, the dissolution of the superego could be added to a political aim, the dissolution of the state, could a revolution truly occur? The instincts and the proletariat must triumph together, or not at all." Reich antedated the attempt of the Frankfurt School to amalgamate sociology, Marx, and psychology, Freud, to play the game of relating ideological to psychological process. He was, note Reif, far more forthright than later players at the same game, say Erich Fromm in Escape from Freedom. Freud's ideology of the emancipation, liberalism, wanted an elite management of the id so as to adjust it to a Gentile world, not a complicity with it to liberate it from that world. Thus for Reich, as Reif tells it, liberalism was understood to function in society as the superego functioned in the psyche, a sham of civility pulled over the reality of conflict, and therefore powerless against doctrines of conflict once these break through the surface of social life. Genuine revolutionary doctrine, on the other hand, functioned in society as the pure biological impulses do in the psyche. Reactionary impulses come straight from the middle level of the psyche, as reactionary regimes come from the middle classes of society. Fascism was the most powerful expression of the political level of the repressed unconscious. End of the block quote. The sharp impression Reich wished to convey of our moral condition, of the fact that we proudly call our neurotic weaknesses character, is an impression, concludes Reif, more politely conveyed by the Fromms and Horneys. H-O-R-N-E-Y-S. Reich's message, in other words, was the message of pariah affect, homeless in a world it never made. A kind of integrity, not merely compulsive contrariness, forced him to shape a medium appropriate to his message. The message was, naturally, impolitely conveyed. So the man was obviously sick, quote unquote. Is there a man in the house who will stand up and say right out that he wasn't? Character armor begins in politeness, in civility. Character armor, which ultimately, Reich maintains, obstructs the involuntary convulsion of orgasm from the complete discharge of sexual excitation and sexual intercourse, originates in the trivial, everyday exchange of civilities and social intercourse. The impoliteness of total sexual orgasm, its social ostracism, so to speak, becomes with Reich the explicit metaphor, as it was more covertly with Freud, for the vulgarity and awkwardness of the Jew in the mixed company of high Gentile social intercourse. The id was, indeed, an unwitting code word for the yid. From the 1940s to the 1970s, these ideas of Reich made their way into the texture of urban American culture. Jacqueline Suzanne, in her novel Valley of the Dolls, speaks of her WASP heroine as having lived with her good New England family in the same, quote, orderly kind of house, smothered with orderly, unused emotions, emotions stifled beneath the creaky iron armor called manners. The hero of Stanley Elkin's The Dick Gibson Show, on a bus late at night between Des Moines and Chicago, makes a pass at the girl in the seat beside him. She shrieks and slaps him, but quite soon they are having a couple of jolly orgasms together. Elkin draws the moral. What a lesson. So much for your timidities and reservations, so much for your doubts and reluctances, your equivocations and hesitancies and shields of decorum more heavy than the world. Pah for your civilizing trepidations. How many words there are for it, I could go on forever. One smash of passion and the poof when appearance. And poof when appearance. Many of the better writers of the second generation of the Eastern European immigration also found that Reich spoke to their condition. Norman Mailer and poet Carl Shapiro, for example. Paul Goodman combined, these are all mid-century writers, combined Reich with Kafka, Paul Goodman, the hero of Saul Bellow's Henderson the Rain King, discovers on arrival that his African chieftain possesses the complete works of Wilhelm Reich. In Isaac Rosenfeld's haunting novel, Passage from Home, published the year following the English language edition of Reich's character analysis, we read of the hero's stepmother hovering over her unwelcome guest, Minna, armed with a smile. Bellow recalls that it was only after, Saul Bellow, a Jew, of course, it was only after Rosenfeld had given up the Reichsianism, which for a time had absorbed us both, that he, quote, no longer questioned people impulsively about their sexual habits or estimated the amount of character armor they wore. But in depth psychology itself, Wilhelm Reich's heir was clearly Fritz Perls. If Reich used Freud's analytic situation as a revolutionary laboratory and model to transform the Western social situation, much as John Dewey once wanted to use the school to transform rather than reflect the society outside, it was left to the late Dr. Frederick S. Perls to transform Reich's individual analytic situation into Reichian group therapy sessions. In his Esalen Institute Gestalt Therapy sessions, he struggled to create a social situation that would have all the properties of both a public encounter with strangers and a primary private living with family-type familiars. That was the model, or the attempt at Esalen. This is 70s stuff. So to go from Freud has an individual wilderness in the clearing, and then they try to take that to the group level and a very destructive group therapy sessions. Again, E. Michael Jones is a good one to read about group therapy. I forget, in either Libido Dominandi or The Revolutionary Jew, he goes into this and how a lot of ex-nuns, and they want this route. And he has a lot about Reich, Charles Reich. If Freud attempts to create in diaspora the shtetl Jew on a temporary 50-minute regressive basis, Perls would recreate the shtetl as a group in all the defense witness of group affect. So Freud kind of has given him a break from the difficulties and travails of trying to pass in Goy society, whereas these other ones are more radical in principle, and they want to recreate society in the way that makes Jews comfortable, psychologically. And you could see how that could be married, since they believe that would destroy Goy society. It could be married to multiculturalism later, since, after all, other non-white peoples have less control than whites do. At least the blacks and browns. Asians might have more control, some of them. If we turn to Perls's Gestalt therapy verbatim, all of which is extracted from audio tapes made at weekend dreamwork seminars conducted by Perls at the Esalen Institute in Big Sur, California, from 1966 through 1968, we see the original adversary thrust of the diaspora intelligentsia reappearing once more. After the ritual references in his introduction, Quote, "At this moment, it seems to me that the race is about loss to the fascists. Pearls goes down to the real business of, quote, encounter therapy, unquote, by saying, I'm not talking about ourselves as social beings. I don't talk about the pseudo-existence, but of the basic natural existence. After assuring us, like Eric Fromm, that we are living in an insane society, unquote, and insisting, quote, but I am not nice, unquote, my emphasis, not. He goes on to distinguish three classes of verbiage production in his therapy sessions. Chicken shit, this is good morning, how are you, and so on. Bullshit, this is because rationalization, excuses, and elephant shit. This is when you talk about philosophy, existential gestalt therapy, etc. What I am doing now. Reich's three-layered personality has acquired two more layers in Big Sur. The first layer is the cliché layer. If you meet somebody, you exchange clichés. Good morning, handshake, and all of the meaningless tokens of meeting. Behind the cliché layer is the role-playing layer, the VIP role, the nice little girl, the good boy roles. So these are the superficial social as-if layers. We pretend, Pearls continues, to be better, tougher, weaker, more polite, etc., than we really feel. Pearls' emphasis, beneath that is the third layer where we experience nothingness. We feel stuck and lost. Behind this impasse layer lies the fourth, the death layer, or the implosive layer, Pearls' emphasis, which, when really contracted, explodes into the fifth or explosive layer. We become authentic, capable of experiencing and expressing the four basic kinds of genuine explosive emotions: grief, orgasm, anger, and joy. By the end of 1968, Pearls was coming to the conclusion that the workshops and group therapy are obsolete, and we are going to start our first Gestalt kibbutz next year. The permanent membership of the kibbutz was to have been 30, with the final differentiation between staff and Sumerians eliminated. The main thing is the community spirit enhanced by ... therapy. This Gemeinschaft community was meant to be a growth experience, and we hope that this time we can produce real people, Pearls' emphasis. We can gather the direction in which Pearls would have taken his kibbutz from the following verbatim segment from an intensive four-week workshop at the Esalen Institute in the summer of 1968. Here we have some dialogue exchange. Blair, I have an unfinished situation with you, Fritz. Fritz, yeah? B, Blair, quietly angry. I don't know what kind of gestalt bullshit you were trying to pull last night when I asked you for a match, but all I want is a simple yes or no when I ask you for a match, not a bunch of verbal messing around until I come up with the right combinations of words and you come across with a match. And another thing, if I want a damn sermon on social etiquette, I'll ask you for it. As far as I'm concerned, you enter my life space when I get up there on that damn chair and no other time. I'm not interested. F, gently, so what should I do? B, just don't mess up my mind when I ask you for a match. You can say a yes or no and that's enough, and I'll let you know when I want. When I want you, and that's up there in the hot seat. F, you made one mistake. You didn't ask me for a match. Blair, loudly. Oh, yes, I did. 99% of the people in America, when you say, have you a match? Those people who are over 10 years old, that is, don't come up and say, yeah, I got a match, or some cute little fucking thing like that. You knew what I meant. Why did you fuck around? Dale, those are all dishonest people. Don't give me that crap, Dale. Are you coming to my defense? Oh, no, I'm just telling him. No, you do fine for yourself. Blair, still mad. That's bullshit. That's the gestalt game. That's what it is. And you can't look at me honestly and say you didn't know that I wanted a match. Fritz, coyly. Oh, I knew that you wanted a match. Blair, then why did you pull that crap? Because I pull all that crap. Because I am the 1%. Laughter. Oh, brother, I want to get out of here. That's a good resentment. Blair, you know, I'm getting so I don't even resent you anymore. Blair waves an admonishing finger at Fritz. You earn your money when you sit in that chair, and Fritz mimics Blair's pointing finger. Yeah, bad boy. Laughter. You are A-okay. You play the rules, I'll play mine. Just don't. My rules are, when I ask for a match, you know, just give it to me. Give me a straight answer. Fritz, so can you also appreciate what I did? Blair, of course, let me tell you. I'm not alone on that jazz, Fritz, but that doesn't keep me from being damn pissed. The fact that, Fritz interrupts him, The fact is that blah, anemic guy you were two weeks ago is now coming out with real anger. End of that. As the 70s got underway, title to Reich's damned sermon on social etiquette passed from Fritz Perls to Arthur Janov. Asterisk. In France, the title passed in the 1960s to the anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss, as we shall see in part two. Author of The Primal Scream, Arthur Janov, Janov. Author of The Primal Scream. If to dress too loudly is a breach of taste, and if to talk too loudly is a breach of civility, to scream is tantamount to a revolution. In his portrait of Russian Jewish immigrants in England, Robert Kotlowitz, in his finely observed novel Somewhere Else, depicts the growing frustration of the Pilchik sisters as they find others unmoved by their arguments for revolutionary socialism. Quote, "So, boys," Anna said in an unnaturally loud voice to Zygmunt and Mendel one Saturday in the sisters' flats, "no use playing with theories. You want to change the world, help us change it. Come to our meeting this week. We need young men like you. You don't know how much work there is to do. It won't be easy to socialize this country. Everyone has manners. Everyone knows how to behave. Everyone is too nice. They have to learn how to scream." Another asterisk. In his memoir, Baltimore Boy, Kotlowitz, born in 1924, recounts how the old synagogues disappeared and how, quote, "the gnarled, crackling Hebrew of the Bible slowly began its transformation at services into the resonant dignity of English, as even Orthodox congregations began to pray more and more in the national language, and with that has come a paling of Jehovah himself into a neat, even-featured image of polite dignity, in short, an Anglo-Saxon god. This polite dignity is paralleled by the development in the Baltimore Cantor's son of a polite personality. Above board, I was a neat, pleasant, well-mannered boy who paid attention to the rules. It was easier that way." Baltimore Boy, Robert Kotlowitz, Growing Up Jewish, editor J. David, New York Pocket Books, 1970, page is 252-243. The story originally appeared in Harper's, December 1965. And last paragraph on 116, end of this chapter, this session in part one of the book. The secret inner bond between overthrowing property and outraging propriety. See, again, that's good writing right there because it's memorable. Cudahy's good at that. The secret inner bond between overthrowing property and outraging propriety was clear to the Pilchik sisters. And, you know, I would certainly have to think E. Michael Jones has read this and was, because it's very, very, leads very naturally not only to what McDonald does, but to what E. Michael Jones does. And, you know, these are some of my favorites. The secret inner bond between overthrowing property and outraging propriety was clear to the Pilchik sisters. It had not been obvious to Karl Marx. He had to learn the connection the hard way. Like Freud, Marx experienced civility as censorship. This fact supplies the inner link between two ideologies of the Jewish intellectual culture of the diaspora, Freudianism and Marxism. Civility as censorship. Anyway, that will conclude our work for today on chapter 13 of The Ordeal of Civility. And we see that how these Jews, the manners, the morals, the ideas, how it's all bound together, and how the Jews come to understand how Aryan society fits together so that they can change it, which is to say destroy it, which is to say remake it so that it serves the interests of their tribe and their race. I say on the day in which they vote on the Brexit, the British possible leaving of the EU, just to date this in time. Anyway, thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real, real soon. We'll move on to part two, Karl Marx and Claude Lévi-Strauss in The Ordeal of Civility.